Okay, yeah, those are the articles. This mm-hmm. is the synopsis from Wikipedia that I printed out.
Sweet. Oh my goodness.
Those are the song lyrics.
I think about that day. I left him at a Graham station. Rest of Santa Day. We were 17. But he was sweating at this point. So I knew when I had you.
Without a nickel too many. Hopped on a bus.
Hopped on a bus, here I came. Could be brave or just insane. We'll have to see. Cause maybe in that sleepy town, you'll sit one day, the lights are down. You'll see my face and think of how he used to know me. Climb these hills, I'm reaching for the heights and chasing all the lights that shine. And when they let you down, boom, you'll get up off the ground.
No, you'll get up off the ground.
Cause morning rolls around and it's another day of sun. I hear them every day. The rhythms in the canyons that'll never fade away. The ballads in the barrooms left by those who came before. They say you gotta want it more. So I bang on every door. And even when the answer's no, or when my money's running low, the dusty mic and neon glow are all I need. Someday as I sing my song, a small town kid'll come along. That'll be the thing to push him on it. Whatever.
That's actually my least favorite lyric in that song. That'll be the one to push him on and go, go. Like, what?
That was weird.
That's so lazy.
I also thought that has a technical problem to it.
All right.
Do we need to do bullshit reel, or are we just gonna...
I think we have us singing the opening song of the movie.
Okay. Welcome to Why Do We Watch This, the podcast where three friends watch a troubled movie, make a cocktail, and talk about what's wrong with it. That's what we normally do, but this is a mini-episode. And yet for this mini-episode, that's what we're doing. I'm Brendan Drischler.
I'm Chris Revell.
Hey, it's me, Brendan Nystad.
Again!
Right, and the other thing was, we decided a while ago that we wanted to talk about La La Land.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the possibility of doing an episode about La La Land.
And here we are.
One of our three members didn't want the chance to participate in that. So we waited for her to leave the country and then decided to record this episode without her.
Sneaky.
Yeah. So while Lee is in England, the three of us decided to talk about La La Land.
Yeah, this is sort of like an ambush full episode.
Yeah.
Like, you thought what you're getting was a mini, and that's how it'll be titled and whatnot, but what you're really getting is three more white men talking about La La Land.
I know.
Which I know is what you're missing from life.
There were not enough hot takes on La La Land, so we decided to throw ours into the ring.
Oh, man.
For our next full-length episode, Brendan will be back, and we will be doing Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, which I think we, at least, are pretty excited to delve into.
So excited!
Because we have spent a lot of time talking about the prequels. So this is going to be a fertile ground for us to discuss. The drink that we have planned for Attack of the Clones is called a Tatooine Sunrise. It is one part mezcal, one part cherry hearing, one part sweet vermouth, one part orange juice, and it should be shaken with ice and then strained into a glass, and I'm pretty excited for that one. To accompany the movie as sort of another last-minute impulse, we decided to make a mocktail.
Mm.
I call it My Drunk Aunt Jumped in the Sen. And it's made with club soda, limeade, lime juice, simple syrup, and a mint sprig. We muddled the mint and we mixed everything all together,
mm-hmm.
and added some crushed ice and threw it in a glass. And we got ourselves a little minty Prohibition-era mocktail here.
I thought it was so good. I was bitching that we didn't have nicer weather to enjoy such a summer.
Yeah, it would be perfect for the summer. It's very minty and fresh and not too heavy, not too sweet.
Yeah, so do you guys want to just get into this?
Please. Where do we start?
Well, we start with a synopsis of La La Land, which I have right here, which I printed up from Wikipedia because it gave a pretty thorough synopsis. So
thanks, Wikipedians.
Yeah, thank you,
and honestly,
La La
like,
nerds.
Just thank you to Brendan who just he came to this
who?
Recording,
but not me one.
Not
thank
the
you.
Other one.
Just make sure the credit is given where
Sorry,
it should be.
The Brendan Drischler for coming to this with papers. We
yeah.
have lyrics. We have hot takes. We
mm-hmm.
have a synopsis from Wikipedia. This is great.
Yeah. Stuck in traffic on a Los Angeles highway, song, Another Day of Sun, Mia, an aspiring actress, has a moment of road rage with Sebastian, a struggling jazz pianist. Her subsequent audition goes poorly. That night, Mia's roommates take her to a lavish party in the Hollywood Hills, song, Someone in the Crowd. During a gig at a restaurant, Sebastian slips into a passionate jazz improvisation despite warnings from the owner to stick to the set list. Mia, moved by the music she hears as she passes by, enters the restaurant. The owner fires Sebastian, who storms out, brushing off Mia as she attempts to compliment him. Months later, Mia runs into Sebastian at a party playing Take On Me in a 1980s pop cover band. She teases him by requesting I Ran So Far Away, a song he considers, quote, an insult for a serious musician. Ugh. After the gig, the two walk to their cars, lamenting each other's company despite the chemistry between them, song A Lovely Night. Mia shows Sebastian around the movie lot where she works as a barista, explaining her passion for acting. Sebastian takes Mia to a jazz club, describing his passion for jazz and desire to open his own club. They warm to each other, song City of Stars. Sebastian invites Mia to a screening of Rebel Without a Cause. Mia accepts, forgetting a commitment with her current boyfriend. Bored with that date, she runs to the theater, finding Sebastian as the film begins. The two conclude their evening with a romantic fantasy dance at the Griffith Observatory. After more failed auditions, Mia decides, at Sebastian's suggestion, to write a one-woman play. Sebastian begins to perform regularly at a jazz club, and the two move in together. Sebastian's former classmate, Keith, invites him to be the keyboardist in his jazz fusion band, with a steady income. While dismayed by the band's pop style, Sebastian signs after overhearing Mia trying to convince her mother that Sebastian is working on his career, song, City of Stars Reprise. Mia attends one of their concerts, song, Start a Fire, but is disturbed, knowing Sebastian does not enjoy his band's music. During the band's first tour, Mia and Sebastian get into an argument. She accuses him of abandoning his dreams, while he claims she liked him more when he was unsuccessful. Mia leaves. Sebastian misses Mia's one-woman show due to a photo shoot he had forgotten. The play is a disaster, few people attend, and Mia overhears dismissive comments. Despondent, she moves back home to Boulder City, Nevada. Sebastian receives a call from a casting director who attended Mia's play, inviting her to a film audition. Sebastian drives to Boulder City and persuades Mia to attend. The casting directors ask Mia to tell a story. She sings about her aunt who inspired her to pursue acting, song, Audition, The Fools Who Dream. Sebastian and Mia profess they will always love each other but are uncertain of their future. 5 years later, Mia is a famous actress and happily married to another man with whom she has a daughter. One night, the couple stumbles upon a jazz bar. Noticing the Sebs logo she had once designed, Mia realizes Sebastian has opened his club and they spot each other. He plays their love theme, and in a lengthy fantasy dance sequence, the two imagine what might have been had their relationship worked perfectly. Before Mia leaves with her husband, she shares a smile with Sebastian. The end. Oof. Filmed in Hollywood, USA.
Boo.
So, I just want to say, we all saw this in theaters, right?
Yes.
We all saw this before the Golden Globes, before the Oscars.
Yeah.
We saw this relatively soon as to when it had come out, I believe.
At least like, here. I think it got an LA release
there was definitely like a New York LA thing mm-hmm. first, but when it opened in wide release in Boston, I think I went like 2 weeks or so after it opened. You had seen it, Brendan. You had seen it before I did.
Yes, I did.
And Chris, you had seen it around that time, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to start off this saying, I think I at least went into the movie with a pretty open mind. I knew it was getting a lot of really great buzz. You know, people were responding really well to it. I was excited that it was a musical because we don't get those too often.
Mm-mm.
I left the theater thinking it was okay, but I had problems with it. And then the more I thought about it, I realized that those problems were very difficult for me to overcome. What did you guys think?
I had an identical experience. When I first saw it, I thought, this is fine. I felt underwhelmed. I felt mm-hmm. like in that moment, I didn't have a lot. I thought like, well, I didn't like this part or this part, but in general it was fine. I just thought maybe people had oversold its merits a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. I never really got hooked. And then same deal. I just thought about, like, this is what kind of brings me to the table tonight. It's not good.
No, yeah, my reaction was the same. I came into it, like, thinking, well, you know, this seems like something that will appeal to me. This looks like it'll speak to me, like, as a Californian, as somebody that likes musicals. And
as someone who just likes to give complicated directions,
as a man who loves jazz,
yeah, as a white man that loves explaining jazz to white women. I had heard mostly positive things about it, and especially some people that I like on Twitter were really bullish on it and saying that it was really charming and really nice. And so I went into it thinking, you know, I'm hoping this will speak to me or do something for me. And by the end of the movie, I turned to my girlfriend and say, well, so what do you think of that? She says, I thought it was okay. And I said, yeah, I thought it was okay. And then the more I think about it, the more I analyze it. It's my opinion of it gets worse and worse. Like,
okay, well, let's kick this off then. I was doing a lot of research on this movie, mm-hmm. both after I saw it and today. And there are a lot of people talking about La La Land as a musical from the perspective of people who I don't think know musicals very well. And I don't want to say that you have to know musicals to assess a musical. Mm-hmm. I think it helps, certainly, to have some sort of idea as to what you're talking about. But the thing that I keep wanting to say is that a lot of what I was reading is people saying, fact about the movie, and this is strange for a musical, like, there right. are really only two characters, and that's strange for a musical. Like, it's strange if you don't know that many musicals. Like people being like, you're like, oh, and the opening number doesn't have a lot to do with those characters, and that's a weird thing. Like, no, it's not that weird. That's... Like, it's not, like, necessarily common, but it's certainly not, like, an anomaly.
It's not unheard of.
Yeah. And so one of the things I kept getting is the fact that it was focusing on a relationship between two people. There is a musical called The Last 5 Years, which focuses right. on the relationship Entirely. Between two people and does it better.
Yeah. I love The Last 5 Years. I think it's wonderful.
One question that I have regarding some of the criticism of this and the way that I view it is that, like, okay, so it is a movie musical, but it is also an original piece. Mm-hmm. It's not adapted from a Broadway show. Right. How are we supposed to judge this? Like, are mm-hmm. we supposed to judge this as if we were judging it as if it were a show that was adapted from Broadway? Like, something really tried and true? Or are we supposed to, like, Damien Chazelle talks about this movie as far as, like, Singing in the Rain and, like, the great, yeah. like, traditional movie musicals that maybe don't necessarily have a lot of original songs or a lot of songs. The style's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Like, I never know, like, how to analyze this. It's so weird because it wants to be a musical, but it doesn't really commit. But it has original music, but it's not a Broadway thing. And like,
but it wants to be modern, but it wants to also be the Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, it wants to be retro, so modern, yeah.
But let's talk about La La Land as a musical right yeah. now, since we kind of segued into that.
All right, why not?
Yeah. I think walking away, my biggest problem that I had, like the most overt problem, I guess I would say to me, was that La La Land is not a good musical.
No.
It fails in what you want a musical to do. So looking at like what influenced Damien Chazelle for this, he was saying, you know, things like Singing in the Rain, musicals from the Arthur Freed unit, MGM in the 1950s, and he was also saying The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Right,
which
and The Girls of Rochefort.
Yes, those feel like a more direct comparison to me in terms of like not great singers, a thin plot. But the difference is that there's a lot of singing in those musicals. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of singing. Like, there are some, like, again, I don't want this to be, like, all musicals, but most musicals have more than 6 songs. yeah. Singing in the Rain has many songs. Like, I was trying to think of, like, movie musicals that did not have that many songs from, like, the 40s and 50s, and all I got was the adaptation of On the Town because it, like, cut, like, almost the entire score and wrote
really?
Songs. Oh. Yeah. But it has very few songs, and that is the one that I think feels close to me in terms of this. But that, as I said, is an anomaly. If you are looking to make a musical that pays like homage to the MGM movie musicals, one, there's a lot of singing, and two, typically people are very good singers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and if they're not, it's interesting the mention of Umbrellas of Cherbourg because... Yes, that is a musical with maybe less than great singers, but what they make up for it instead is, like, unbelievably staged
mm-hmm.
set pieces and so much, like, charm and charisma yeah. and chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to go in that direction, they could have.
Yeah.
They did not have the other thing to offer us in place of good singing.
No, totally.
Because the leads in this musical cannot sing well.
I don't even mind a little bit of thin singing here and there, but I think for me the thing that kind of kills this as a musical for me is that a lot of the songs don't feel like they advance the story or tell you anything more about the characters.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the song, at the end of the song, like, nothing has really changed. They haven't discovered something about themselves.
Right.
The only song where that happens is the audition piece, I think. Yeah.
I think another thing, Brendan, at least for you and I, is we're both big fans of Stephen Sondheim.
Yes.
So we come at a lot, like, and again, not all musicals. Not all musicals need to be Stephen Sondheim. There are other musicals that I enjoy quite a lot that are not written by him.
Sure.
That said, I think he is, in my opinion, like, the best composer lyricist.
Oh, he's the master.
So what the thing is a lot of the time, I look at musicals from what I know about what he has written about writing musicals.
Absolutely.
And it's like you said, in terms of, like, songs going on a journey. Like, the point of a song is that you have to go from A to B, and something has to happen in between that point. Like, if you just stand up and sing, like, I love this guy. I love him so much. I love him a lot. And then you, like, sit down. It's like, well, that's a good song. But, like, what did I get from this? I get that, like, you love him. And, like, but I learned nothing else about him. Mm-hmm. And I learned nothing about the situation. That, I think, is a big point for me. For the most part, you could cut the songs out of this movie and not miss a whole lot in terms of plot. There were a few. The audition song and I would say Someone in a Crowd are the two ones that, like, are... One is a character song and one is more of a plot song.
Right.
And so if you were to completely snip those scenes out, you would miss something from the movie. The other songs, I think, pretty much entirely could go and you would not be confused as to what you've missed.
Yeah. That being said, I think the three of us can agree that the first two songs, Another Day of Sun and Someone in the Crowd, are really quite good.
Yeah, I think...
And well-staged. They're
really
and
enjoyable.
Fun
yeah.
to watch. Mostly well-performed. My only criticism with Someone in the Crowd is every time one of Emma Stone's roommates sings, it really emphasizes how unsuited her voice is for the material.
Yeah.
The other thing, I think, going back to, like, Sondheim, though, is, again, this is, like, something, like, you get from his shows a lot, where he prefers actors who sing over singers who can act. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of Sondheim shows, you have people who are not, like, conventionally great voices. Like, Elaine Stritch has done so many. And, like, she is not what you would consider to be, like, a pleasant voice to listen to. Like, Judi Dench does a fantastic Send in the Clowns that is great because of, like, the emotion she puts into it and how angrily she delivers each line. But it's not like you would turn on the radio and be like, ooh, I can't wait to hear Judi Dench sing Send in the Clowns. Like, that's not something that you want. So, like, and again, like, even in, like, the movie ones, like I know you have different thoughts than I do about the movie version of Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd, yeah.
But I do not mind the voices in Sweeney Todd because I think for the most part they act the songs well. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what is missing from this, is that Ryan Gosling just kind of mumbles his way through most of the lyrics.
Just generally speaking, and this will be my position going forward throughout the night, I think Emma Stone acquits herself a lot better than Ryan Gosling.
I think the audition song works because Emma Stone acts it very well.
I also think, in general, her performance in this movie is quite good. Because, especially when you consider, her character of Mia has almost nothing to it.
They devoted way too much time to Seb and all of his jazz obsession and his sister and the band and all that stuff gets so much focus. And then everything with Mia is, like, shorthand. It's so weird.
Well, again, like, what we know about her is she was in a small town. She has a drunk aunt who jumped in the Seine. And she likes old movies, but doesn't know Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, she's never seen it.
Yeah.
Or Citizen Kane.
So, like, she likes movies, but what movies does she like? I don't know. What is her relationship with her roommates? I don't know.
Not unclear.
Like, what is anything else about her?
I don't know. And what's crazy...
Well, she works in a coffee shop.
I'm sorry. She's a barista. My bad.
Right.
Ryan Gosling says a barista, and it really...
Me too! I had a moment where I was like, it's barista.
Burrito?
But yeah, it's interesting too. It really occurred to me how unevenly these characters are set up with each other. In one of the montages where it's cutting back and forth between Seb caught up at the photo shoot and Mia doing her one-woman show, we see so much of a photo shoot that I could not give two shits about.
Oh, yeah, like the whole... I was so... That fucking photographer was like, bite your teeth, love, bite your teeth. Play a song, love. We had, like, so much of this fucking guy doing his business with Ryan Gosling making faces.
It's not even funny.
No.
And it's all in service of just letting us know, for the umpteenth time, that Ryan Gosling is a true blue jazz musician, and he's so serious about it, he's the best, and he's the jazz messiah of Los Angeles. And we're told multiple times, and we get it in little scenelets with Emma Stone. We see her in a few, like, reads and audition scenes where she's, like, kind of kills it, but it isn't being recognized. So you'd think that if we're going to cut in between these two things, we're going to see some of her show. No. We see right before it begins, and we see the final silent moment.
And then every the four people applaud.
Right.
And the thing is, that becomes such a plot point when she gets the call.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're like, we saw you in the show. Like, I didn't.
No.
As an audience member, I didn't see you in the show.
Maybe the show was terrible. Yeah. Maybe she was really ashamed.
This is the other thing that I want to know what you guys think, because this was something I was reading, and people cannot come to a consensus on this, which I think speaks volumes of the fact that the movie does not know what to say.
You know what? Let's lock it down tonight.
Are they talented? Is Emma Stone a good writer? Is her show good? Do you think her show is supposed to be good? Do you think she walks away from this being like, acting is what I need to do. I should never write anything again. Because wow. I've heard people like make the argument that like, well, I think her show is supposed to not be very good. And I will be the one to say her show does not look very good because of the fact that she is writing a one-woman show about moving out of her small town, which like... I've never heard of a one-woman show about you leaving your small town before.
Maybe that's just a thing you do in L.A. that we're not aware of. I don't know.
Okay, here's the thing. I would actually, not to, like, punt here, but I don't think we can make that judgment.
I don't think we can either, but I find it interesting that so many people are debating about, like, well, I think the movie wants you to think that they're not.
Well, I don't think the movie even thought about it, because the movie doesn't think about her character or her art. And I actually, when I was rewatching it to kind of refresh myself for this, I feel like that entire missed play was a failure thing was just a setup to show us Ryan Gosling is the one that brings her back and is technically the like deliverer of her eventual success, right? See, because she would never have gone to this Miracle audition if he hadn't like come and dragged her out of the house and da-da-da-da.
Honked on the
horn. So it almost just doesn't matter because I feel like they were like, well, we just need a perfunctory thing that takes one of her characters away and requires the other one
to... It would have been so easy to do that without her running one-man show. It could have just been, I've been to 3,000 auditions in my time here and it's never gotten me anything. I have fucking had it with this town.
I like the idea of her doing like one last big thing to try and get some attention. But I don't know if this was the right thing to
do. Well, and again, does she like writing? Did she have a good time? Something she wants to do?
I think that's one thing that this movie tries to convince you of and kind of fails, is that these two characters unlock things in each other and empower each other to do these things that they've always wanted to do. But it's just that it's done in a way where
Ryan Gosling get out of
this? Well, I was going to say...
He gets the club.
He gets
but
the
like
club.
How? Would he not have gotten this?
He doesn't get the club in the alternate ending we see.
Well, he goes on tour, right? He didn't want to go on tour because he wanted to be a serious jazz musician.
But he went on tour because Emma Stone's mom made him feel bad.
So, no, it's a conversation he overheard that was Emma Stone's half of it.
Yeah,
yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, it's her being like, well, yeah, he's serious, like, he's blah, 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 blah.
See, I read that scene as he was just misunderstanding that she was just sort of brushing her mom off and just being like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying her point, my point is not of what Emma Stone's intentions were. My point is that if he wasn't dating Emma Stone, would he have overheard a conversation between a girl and her mom being like, well, Ryan Gosling is probably just saving up for a jazz club.
Right.
Would not Ryan Gosling have probably continued to play at the jazz club he was playing at, and then maybe eventually gotten a club? So like, what he gets a job with John Legend, his old college roommate,
or something.
He plays with, he goes on tour with them for a while, he quits and goes back to playing jazz. Where did the money come from? Did it come from the 2 months that he was on tour with them?
Good question.
So what my point is, what did he get from her? He didn't get... My point is, I don't think he got anything.
I don't think
he
got anything.
I think he got mildly confused. Yeah.
I mean, love. I don't know. It's...
But, like, again, it's just that, like, she comes away, and now she loves jazz. And now she knows that she can maybe write a one-woman show, and she has more confidence. What the fuck does he have that he did not have at the beginning of this movie?
See, that's actually one of the problems with the characters. Because the movie... Okay, and I'm going to really try not to be on my soapbox too long about this, but this really got under my skin. The movie is very convinced that Mia needs to grow and change, and that she needed Ryan Gosling specifically, who does not need to grow and change, to put her there.
Yeah.
So he doesn't need anything from her, because as far as the movie is concerned, he's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he gets a mild but extremely needed reproach from John Legend, where he's essentially like, you're too rigid, you're actually coming back around to being kind of anti-jazz in this way that you are, you know, completely against change and fusion and... And I was like, yes, that's great, but the movie is so in love with Ryan Gosling as a character that he will never have a journey.
Whenever that scene happened and John Legend said that, I was like, oh, wow, like, that's actually a good point.
Yeah.
What will Ryan Gosling do as prompted by this? And the answer is nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
He will stay the course.
Yeah, and it's not that he ever comes away and is like, you know, like, John Legend has a point. Like, jazz is not what I think it is. Jazz is whatever a musician wants it to be. Like, he doesn't. His club is exactly the club that he fantasizes about having. And it's just the other thing is, in the scene where he's playing with John Legend, and they're playing their like funky
on stage, you mean?
Yeah, electronic jazz number that apparently packs people into concert halls.
They love it.
They fucking
liked it.
No, it's okay. Right. Also, can I say it's my favorite song from the movie? Like, it's the song that I would listen to the most in real life.
I perked up when it came on. Yeah. I was like, hey,
well, it has energy.
It's a fun number. Like, what a fucking novel idea. But my point is, so you see him on stage playing like keyboards, and you see Emma Stone in the audience, and I found it difficult to read her expression at first, because at first I thought she was sort of like, wow, like, this is different, but he seems like he's having a good time.
He did, though, right?
Yeah, and that was my take on it, was that she was like, well, this isn't what he wanted, but he looks like he's having fun. But apparently, her reaction is, this is not the, like, the rigid-ass jazz that you initially told me was the only way to play jazz.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think even if, like, Ryan Gosling had been like, you know, like, yes, I know that this is not what I initially set out to do, but, like, I am enjoying this.
Yeah.
It would have been a different thing.
I don't think that he's given a chance to, like, explain his point of view. What we can infer from what happens with the club being kind of like the rigid traditionalist slant is that he learned nothing from his little career journey, and he came back to what he knew and didn't change at all.
Here's what also annoyed me about that is, by the way, I loved the I thought it was a well-done shot of her kind of receding into this crowd that's surging forward.
Yeah.
But the look on her face is such utter terror. Mm-hmm. And it is, really, because she, or like disgust or something. And when I saw that, I thought initially, my first take was, oh, is she just being like jostled too much? Is she just like, is she just bummed that it's not like for her anymore? Like, that would have been an interesting angle. Nope, our takeaway is supposed to be that jazz fusion is soulless.
Well,
and
that's so judgmental.
Yeah.
It is extremely judgmental. And I also thought it was a very conscious choice that it's not even a Casio keyboard he's playing on stage. It's like a press pad.
It's like rubber.
And we're to take away that because that is a more modern instrument, that makes it soulless. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was judgmental, and I also thought it was lazy.
I think because the movie is very clearly saying that, like, this is not what jazz is.
Okay, and then it just drove me crazy because I was like, really, the sum total of what you have to say is using a modern instrument and maybe playing around with a medium and showing any kind of creativity and spark, that's selling out.
Yeah, what does that say about John Legend's character in this movie? Is he some sort of guy here to, like, tempt Seb away from his pure path?
He seems like a decent... He offers
he
his douchebag
like
roommate
guy.
A job.
Yeah.
A well-paying job in his band.
When John Legend first pops up and then was like, oh, who's that? Seb's reaction to it is as if, like, something really dark happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, it's like Satan popped up and was like,
Well, because he was just, like, old friend. Just the way he acts about it, it's like they, like, killed someone together. Like, I could not get a handle on it.
And there's ex-lovers.
Right. Oh, I mean, that would make Seb interesting.
That would be much more about
that would be interesting.
But he's not interesting. And it is all about him. And he's such a jerk. I spent so much time feeling like, okay, they're building up this character to be this very bullheaded, sort of a dick, but he means well, but he's just sort of stuck in his way, and maybe the movie will have him be flexible. That doesn't happen. He is... I feel like when I was watching that, I was like, this character watched Mad Men and was like, did not get it, and was like, yeah, this is how it should have been. It's just, he's so regressive.
Yeah.
You know, I think the most egregious miscalculation in the scene where he's playing with the band on stages, though, is that the fucking keyboard player for the Messengers made his girlfriend sit in the audience instead of getting her backstage passes.
I know.
Oh,
what a jag-off. I'm just saying, if I was dating the keyboarder for the Messengers, he was like, here's a general admissions, like, go sit in the mosh pit in the front. I'd be like, fuck you.
So I was watching the movie the other night, and I texted Brendan, and so I want to talk about how I think that Ryan Gosling is, like, miscast, and this character should have been somebody who was a little bit more quirky that you could buy as, like, an eccentric.
Yeah.
Because as it is, he's the straight man in this movie. He's like kind of dull.
I think that
the flatness of his character means the stuff that you might be like, okay, he's just an eccentric guy. He's just quirky. Comes off as like, that guy's an asshole.
I think the most charitable way you could read his character would be that he's depressed. But
I think nothing, that's total subtext.
He yells at his sister for sitting on a stool.
I know. I think that was supposed to be the quirk part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, there are parts of him written that are supposed to sound like goofy little quirks, but they just sound like an angry, angry man. Like, he is two steps away from being a men's rights activist. Like, he has the fedora. So he's like almost there. Like, that is the thing that I get from his character, is that he's almost progressing to like this 1950s.
Yes.
Man. Yeah.
Well, and the movie seems to suggest that is the right path.
But Brendan, what you were saying also in terms of the character that I found interesting is that Ryan Gosling is miscast.
Who would you have cast? Just like,
we couldn't come up with a good answer.
It was very difficult. But I will say the first guy that popped into my mind was Jason Schwartzman.
Interesting. Because he does actually play characters like that, doesn't he?
And he is a musician, too.
Yeah. He played that character in Bored to Death, is sort of.
Well, I would say he played it in Shop Girl, where
he totally
did. He's a goofball in Los Angeles who loves a very attractive redheaded woman.
That's true.
But I like Shop Girl a lot, so that's
I do too.
What the only thing I had thought of, and this is not like ideal casting, this is what popped in my head, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Because it's someone, again, like, my biggest conceit, not my biggest conceit with Seb, but one of the problems I have with him is that he's a very classically handsome man with muscles.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a little more wiry. He's mm-hmm. a little, like, I don't want to say, like, he's unattractive, because he is not, but, like, oh my, no. But he's a little less, like, movie star matinee. Like, Ryan Gosling is, like, very, like, matinee man. Like, he's on a poster. Joseph Gordon-Levitt has a little more, like, character juice phase. I think if Sebastian was a little more underdoggy in some way,
mm-hmm.
Might want him more, because like the scene that like that really like so early in the movie made me not like him is when he's talking to J.K. Simmons, who plays the boss at the
yes.
jazz club,
mm-hmm.
and the boss is saying, "Look, I rehired you. Play the set list." And he keeps being like, "I hear what you're saying, but what I think you're really saying is you want me to play more jazz." And like, no, this isn't charming. This isn't funny. Like, you're being a jackass. He fired you once. He gave you another chance, and you're continuing to be like an unrepentant jackass.
But that could have been played differently.
Right? No, if
totally,
he was a little
yeah.
more like nervous, he's like, okay, like get what you're saying, but what you're really saying is you want jazz. Like if it was just sort of like a little more like you didn't want to like punch him in the face,
right?
Yeah.
But a little more like nervous energy.
Well, and I feel like it's maybe that flatness. And I think you're right. Manifests as an asshole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if maybe he played it more broad, and I have to say that about a movie musical. But if they went more broad with his performance, I actually think a lot of the problems would be solved. There's some writing problems with that character.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, because like you said, he is like around the corner from being an MRI.
No, he's a robot who loves jazz and nothing else. Another issue, incidentally, with the scene with J.K. Simmons is that Ryan Gosling is bitching about how they just wanted to play Christmas carols. Like, do you think no fucking jazz musician has ever not made a Christmas album? I have one. Duke Ellington did an entire album of themes from the Nutcracker with a jazz interpretation. So, like, fuck you, Ryan Gosling, for thinking that, like, in no way is there a way to, like, combine jazz and Christmas music.
Yeah. I would also like to bring up one thing that I noticed this the second time that I've seen the movie now. why is it that he is mimicking other jazz musicians by playing back what he hears in the records? Why isn't he improvising on his own? Like,
interesting.
Well, that could have been an interesting route to go, where you're like, oh, he really is too rigid. He does need to let himself feel the jazz more.
Yeah.
But the movie never gets there.
Never gets there.
And, okay, so similar to what you're both saying, there's also this through line that could have been played by a better actor, I think, or by a with a different performance, rather. And Ryan Gosling's a fine actor. This just isn't a good performance for him.
Mm.
Seb is already placing himself so far above what every other artist has ever had to do, which is, yes, you are going to have to play, like, some cheesy Christmas bullshit at the restaurant that is fucking paying you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're going to play whatever, like, goofy 80s music at that one party where you've been booked. Just, like, fucking roll with the punches. You have to actually do the work to get there. And it seems constantly like Sebastian's just like, you know, I'm waiting for this to be dropped in my lap. Why hasn't it yet?
The party scene, actually, because the scene afterward, like, I liked part of the scene where, like, where Emma Stone requests Iran from him, and she's, like, dancing, and she's, like, being, like, cute and coy with the lyrics, and, like, oh, like, ooh, like, you're seeing this. And then when she sees him afterwards, she's, like, being flirty with him, and he just seems annoyed
yes!
that she's, like, that she's, like, done this. And, like, because you could, like, there's a way for him to be self-deprecating and be, like, this is not a song for a serious artist. But, like, he just sounds, like, angry that she dared, like, request an 80s
song. He's been playing 80s songs all afternoon.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
is he mad now at that one
yeah.
song?
Well, I completely agree. And I also, that was another example where I was like, Emma Stone had so little to work with in that scene.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. she did it. I mean, guys.
Do you want to talk about, like, the songs in general?
Yes.
All right. So there are six.
Let's start from the beginning, because
right.
I feel like we're going to start with what's good, right?
right. So we open with Another Day of Sun,
right?
The opening number.
Which, I think, generally speaking, is quite good.
I think it's a good... Okay, so it's a number about people who are in L.A., who have moved to L.A., and are pursuing their dreams, and even when it sucks, at least it's a nice day out.
It's setting the scene.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and another nice day will roll around. It's a whole theme of, even when you're down, you can always get back up and try again.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I mean, it's...
Okay, so that's...
Unchallenging.
This is good. It's a good... No, I think it's a well-shot number. Like, it's very visually interesting. You have, like, the shots of, like, people on bikes and, like, people jumping off cars. And I was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, this is a fun opening number.
There's a lot of unbroken shots,
yeah.
which I thought were pretty
well. They hide.
Yeah,
some
I think
that.
That's what it is. I think it's their hiding shots. But I agree, it's well done. Presumably, this song, the opening number, is sort of like the theme of the musical.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What
the mission
is
statement.
The theme of La La Land? Is it...
Per the song or per what we saw in the movie?
Well, let's talk about both real quick here. Okay. So the theme of the movie La La Land seems to me that you will have to consider sacrificing love for ambition. What is that saying compared to what the opening number of the movie says?
God, the opening number is really just you can have it all and your dreams are worth it. And
well, I don't think it's saying you can have it all. I think it's just saying that you keep trying anyway. But my question is, what do you guys think the theme of La La Land is in general? Like, would you say that's a fair assessment of what is being said in La La Land?
I think I would actually... Man, I don't know.
Yeah, that's hard.
It's interesting really that you're putting that to me because I never thought about what the movie wants to say because I never for a moment thought the movie was trying to say anything.
It's just too many conflicting things.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get a clear
but
read.
It's also just such cotton candy all the way through that I never for once thought, oh, okay, there's a message.
Well, I don't think
somewhere.
It wants to be. Like, I think it wants to be escapist, but it wants to be, like, it wants to say something about, like, people's dreams and relationships. I don't think it wants to be taken as fluff, which is interesting again to me also that so many people are being like, it's escapist and I enjoyed it. And like, I can see why you might, but I don't think this was intended to be like fluff.
That's almost like an apologist defense though, I feel like that comes up when people are like, but it sucked here, here, and here. And they're like, well, I mean, it's just escape. I mean, you get that a lot when it was like, I just wanted to turn my brain off. I'm like, okay.
So I guess my question really is that while it's a good song and it's energetic, and it's well shot.
Does it have anything to do with the movie?
Is it the best choice to open this movie with? Because my answer, answer is I'm not sure. My answer is not definitively yes or no. My point is I don't know I don't know if I'm sure what the theme of this movie is.
I would say now that you're putting that to me like that, I don't think it is.
Okay.
Well, yes and no. Because yes, from a technical perspective, because I felt that it was... In terms of the energy it was giving, in terms of the visuals, that was all pretty good table setting. Here's what you're going to get is this very bouncy, fun experience.
And it looks like Los Angeles.
Yes. Yeah. It gave you a cute idea right off the bat, which is, you know, what if we just put into song all of the musings of people stuck in traffic?
Yeah, it's a good creative idea.
Yes. So I think in terms of, hey, this is what you're going to get, that's a very solid choice. If you're asking me if it has anything to do with the themes of the movie and if it correctly introduces them, no, it doesn't.
Brendan, do you have?
I have a couple of thoughts on this song. I think that it kind of represents the theme of the movie in that it doesn't know if it wants to be more glossy and poppy or if it wants to delve into some of those darker aspects of what it's like to actually pursue your dreams day in, day out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the song sounds really happy, but then I hear some of the lyrics and what the song is about. And I'm like, oh, that's actually kind of depressing. But there's another day of sun.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, that's the silver lining, I guess. But it sounds like this is a really hard life for everybody.
It stabs at something interesting they don't quite get at, which I think you brought up before when we were kind of chatting, which was it hints at this idea of something that has a brightly colored candy shell that is actually much more interesting and dark on the inside.
Yeah.
Which I think would have been a really cool direction to go in, but they don't.
it seems like that kind of wants to be... That's sort of what La La Land maybe wants to be. The idea that it's like, there are bright colored costumes and it looks super pretty, but it's not fluff and there's more happening than you want it to be. And maybe, in a way, this number reflects what La La Land wants to be. So, again, this goes back to the fact that my answer is I don't know if this is the best opening number or not.
Like, it could have been what Glee was for, like, the half of its first season.
You're being charitable. Moving on to the second song, Someone in the Crowd.
This actually might be my favorite.
I would agree, I think.
I think it was the most fun to watch.
It was fun to watch. I think it's generally well-performed. I think it moves the plot along.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, again, it's very Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but I like the look of the four roommates in their dresses going down the street. Like, because you have like red, yellow, blue, and green.
Yes.
And like, it's like, I will say, like, again, something that this movie does well, it looks nice.
Yes.
Like, the use of color is good in this movie.
I also like that when they get to the party, kind of how like the scene freezes.
Yeah.
I want to talk
about that later on.
Now's the time, but I loved that.
It's part of my fixes.
I loved the camera when it pushes in over the pool to people who are kind of frozen mid-movement behind, I guess, like sliding glass doors.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they start moving, it's all like kinetic and fun and interesting.
Yeah,
it's fun, which a lot of the movie is not.
It has a lot of build to it, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like this number, and I think that it sets up my expectations for other numbers to be this stylistic and interesting, and then it doesn't deliver on that whatsoever.
No.
But I think my biggest beef with this number is that there is nobody in the crowd that she is looking for. She doesn't meet anybody at this party, and I don't think that it... I think it fails to really come back around to her dissatisfaction with this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I think that they hint at it. She has that moment where she's going through everyone and their statues, and she's singing to herself, and I just feel like it doesn't really develop her character at all.
No. That's and it could have been. It was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and she wasn't even going to go to the party in the first place. Yeah. So it's like she kind of half-assedly like, oh, I guess I'll put my thing on. I guess we'll go. And then it's like she has kind of a meh time at the party. They don't really show you anything really bad happening, really creepy happening at the party.
No.
So next we have Lovely Night, the two of them having a duet together after the a party that they are both at.
The 80s party. Right?
The 80s pool party.
Yeah. So it's them in front of like on a hilltop at like very, very early in the morning with like the sun just coming up. And it is a dance with a song.
It was,
and I keep forgetting there's a song.
Yeah, I completely forgot there was a song. Because the only thing I remember from that is I remember thinking, wow, this is just a straight up, like, kind of weak tea version of, like, Astaire and Rogers.
Yeah, I mean, it's heavily, it draws from that a lot. And I think they both move well, I guess is what I would say. If they're not great dancers, they move well enough.
I felt like they seemed very tentative, particularly in that scene. Mm. Like, I feel like I could watch them, the wheels turning of, like, okay, and we train to take this step. Like, it never felt fluid or organic.
I'm wondering if that has to do with the production at all, because one thing that got talked up over and over again was the fact that they didn't do anything in a soundstage. Yeah. It was all done on location for real. So this scene, they had to shoot it in
like
chunks.
20 minutes or something?
Yeah, yeah, like over a few days. And I'm wondering if that maybe is like the consequence of you miss that fluidity. You're not able to do it all in one like long chunk.
It's weird too that you're bringing that up, because when I watched that, I thought immediately, that is looks so much like a set.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I know that it's on location, but it just looks so setty.
So I wonder, and this is something Brendan and I had also talked about previously, is if it's supposed to. I'm wondering if it's an intentional choice to film on real locations and make it look as though it would be a soundstage.
Yeah. So well, then why not just use a soundstage?
Because I think that's like what's modern about it. Like, and I don't think that's a bad idea. No, I know, throw your hands up all you want. But I'm saying I don't think that's a bad idea inherently to do a movie on a real, like in a real location and make it and like film it the way you would as if you were on a soundstage. I think there's something at least interesting to that.
I like why? Like what do you gain as a viewer from that experience?
I mean, I think it's just I think it's just a visual take. Like that does not bother me. Perhaps it bothers you more than me.
Yeah.
But the song.
Yeah, City of Stars.
Fine. Oh, City of Stars.
So City of Stars is
the Academy Award winning song.
Academy Award winning song, City of Stars.
How?
Because it's a motif that runs throughout the movie. Ryan Gosling sings a verse of it briefly. The two of them reprise the number later on. Yeah, it's City of Stars. I could not remember what the song was about until I read the lyrics, and I'm still... So it's mostly just him about, like... Well, I'm looking at it right now, so it's just like, maybe I'm in love. I'm a sad boy who's maybe in love now.
Yeah, well, it's also just... I mean, it's really up to Ryan Gosling's, like, mumble singing that I hadn't... past the beginning of just... City of Stars. I didn't know what the other words were. I never got it. And it's also a very dirge-like, boring-sounding song for me. And so I checked out whenever it came back on because I was like, I don't care. It's not grabbing me in any way.
Yeah, this song really highlights the problems with the music not expressing the character's feelings very well. Because he should be singing about, like, oh, you know, I'm in this relationship, but I'm not sure really what's going on. Mm. And, you know, what is... You know, City of Stars is he's singing to Los Angeles. He's singing about Los Angeles, like.
But also,
how does he feel?
Well,
about
no,
it?
See, like, I assume he's singing to because City of Stars, are you shining for me? So I assume it's like directed at the city itself in like an abstract way, like in the sense, like you know, like there are a lot of people in this city, and maybe you meet someone in a place and you fall in love. Again, a conversation you and I had previously, because we have talked about this movie surprisingly a lot. Like, let it not be said that this has not prompted a lot of discussions between us.
Absolutely.
That's what led to this, though, is we all wanted to talk about it.
So I think the biggest issue that is with these songs, I think, is, as we said, a failure to express characters or plot points at certain points. We can't judge the lyricists because mm-hmm. they didn't. It's not like this was a collaborative effort in right. the sense that this director met these two guys and was like, hey, why don't we all write a musical? It right. was, I'm writing this musical. Will you write lyrics for this scene? No, like, presumably they had some input in these things. And, like, I'm not just saying that he literally, like, paid them to, like, show up and write lyrics and go away.
Yeah, maybe.
But, the blame for this has to rest on the director / screenwriter.
Yeah, it's his vision. Yeah. It's his original creation. Yeah.
And so I'm not too familiar. The lyricists are Pasek and Paul, and I'm not too familiar with what they have done. I have been told that a lot of it is pretty good. They tend to write in more of a pop idiom than something I go for. But it's hard for me to assess their abilities as lyricists based off of things like City of Stars.
Mm-hmm. It's just a very uninspired song. I also kept wondering, is the song supposed to be sad?
I think it's supposed to be a little melancholy.
Yeah. Because Ryan Gosling's delivery is so heavy that at times I was not sure. Hmm. That I was like, is this just a problem with the delivery, or was that the direction this was supposed to be going?
I think it's apprehensive and melancholy is okay. how I would describe it. Like, it's a little sad about
it. It's weird then that there isn't like a more up-tempo take when they do their duet together. Yeah. It still is sad, even though they are together. And
yeah, again, I think that partly goes back to the misunderstanding of like Damien Chazelle not really getting how to make a musical.
I would also just say, like, you know, hot take here, but this should not have won the Oscar for Best Original Song.
I mean, how is Lin-Manuel going to EGOT? Come on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but
we'll have to wait for the Little Mermaid movie musical.
You know, I actually, like,
felt... Or Mary Poppins.
Yeah. I actually felt something when I heard that song from Moana.
That's a good song.
I feel like taking a nap when I hear City yeah. of Stars.
Last song, because we're skipping the John Legend song, which doesn't quite count for our purposes.
It's a good song, y'all.
Yeah, I enjoy it. The last song is the audition song My Drunk Aunt Jumped Into the Sun.
I just need to talk about this scene just for a moment.
Yes.
Please do.
How many auditions do you think really go that way? Where you come in and they're like, listen, we have no script. We don't even have a character. This is all going to be created around an actress that we select based on how she's going to deliver this story.
I think that this is something that happens when you're Woody Allen or Wes Anderson and you have talented friends who are in all your movies and you say, like, I have some ideas. What do you guys bring to the table? This is not something that happens when you are making a movie and you drag in this girl who did her one-woman show. Like, again, like, also, like, who is she playing? Is she a major character in this movie? Is she, like, a secondary character? Like, is it literally, like, this girl who did a one-woman show and this is the thing that made you think this girl is going to be a big star? Like, it's more believable to me if she shows up in, like, a secondary role in a movie and that, mm-hmm. like, gets her noticed and then she goes on to bigger and bigger things.
But they never say.
So. Right. But, and so...
Yeah, as 5 years later, yeah. we'll pop out.
Yeah. I know. And so as it stands now, the implication would seem to be that she's getting a major role in this movie that is being written around her in improvised live when she has no real credits to her name.
Which, yeah. you know,
which is not completely inconceivable, but is very inconceivable. But
this does get back to a Mia problem generally, is that they kind of establish her as being disposable.
Yeah.
She's auditioning up against all these other redheads that are basically just clones of her, and we don't really get to know what's super special about her.
Well, I would actually say we do see in what little we see of her audition kind of earlier in the movie.
She's good.
We know she's good.
That's but she doesn't even get callbacks.
Right. Like, so, well, and I guess we're supposed to believe that that's just because LA is a merciless place that you're also supposed to love because it's wonderful. Anyway, I really tried to put myself in the place of these casting agents who, so they're like, tell us a story. And, you know, within musical logic, we can just assume that she didn't really sing this to them.
Oh, no, she's monologue.
Right, it's a monologue. Yeah. So I'm just thinking, if I'm like a casting director and I'm sitting in for this casting, then this woman tells me about someone else who was an alcoholic and then burned out and died.
So, okay.
And that's the clincher for me picking her up
for
our movie?
I don't have a problem with it not being about her.
It's not so much that. It's just such an odd choice to tell that story.
It is, but
it doesn't impart any kind of, like, charm or anything inherent about Mia.
So, no, what I think this song is giving you about Mia is that she learned, like, this defined who she is as a character. I think this is the most you get about Mia as a character.
Absolutely.
In the movie.
Yeah.
Which where is problematic that it's
yeah.
this far in the
yeah,
movie.
It's, yeah, it's, like, nearly the fucking end. And, like, she basically says that, like, I had an aunt whom I loved who was, like, a troubled woman, and she went to Paris, she jumped in the Seine, and she, like, had no regrets about her life, even though she died fairly young. And, like, that made me think that, like, the world needs people who are dreaming. So, like, to be fair, like, if I were to say to you, tell me a story and you told me that, I'd be like, okay, like, that's fine. Like, I have no particular problems with that story.
If this was the song we get leitmotifs of, I would have been into it. Because
yeah,
this
totally.
Would have established earlier on, you know, you see her want to be an actor, but you just kind of take it as rote that it's just something she wants. And it's not until almost the end of the movie that we find out the very elaborate reason why. We could have used this at the top of the movie.
Well, doesn't she mention the aunt earlier?
I don't think so.
I think she might.
Yeah.
She gets like a low key mention.
I think
but
it's
really not
yeah,
called
it's,
out.
It's earlier on when she's first like getting to know Ryan Gosling.
Because
she mentions her aunt.
I'm even fine with saving the song for late, but I need this information a lot.
Totally.
Sooner. Because it's such an 11th hour for you to be like, well, here's who she is as a character. We just spent almost 2 hours trying to get to know someone.
Yeah.
I do think the lyrics are a little hacky in the song.
A little
I
bit.
I think Emma Stone sells it pretty well.
Yes.
And again, that's why she won the Oscar for effectively, like, giving characterization to a character who had, like, nothing.
Nothing.
To do with. And,
which
like,
is...
it's a commendable endeavor on her part to, like, have made you find Mia at all interesting in the movie.
Yeah. This actually might be a better thesis statement than the opening number.
Yeah.
Oh, I think you're so right.
Like, this says, like, you know, as long as you're living your life to the fullest and chasing your dreams, then that's all that truly matters when you
yeah.
die.
Okay, so having talked about all the songs, I think it's good to discuss the ending sequence of this movie. So
yeah.
The movie ends with a fantasy, like, dream ballet sequence where Sebastian and Mia sort of imagine, like, what it might have been like between them
right.
if he had not been a jackass to her. And it's shot entirely on sound stages. Like, you see, like, a soundstage version of L.A., and you see, like, a soundstage version of Paris.
Which was an interesting stylistic choice.
I think... So here's people fucking love this ending, and I get it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Why?
They do. So what I think that they like, I think it's a good ending for the movie in terms of a have your cake and eat it too moment.
Yeah.
I think it looks neat. The uses of soundstage is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like I said, I think the big thing about it is that it allows you to have like a happy ending, but not actually have a happy ending. And I think that's part of it. And I legitimately think that people walk out of the movie feeling better because the ending made them feel better than the movie might have on all. Like, I think
if they didn't do that alternate ending, you mean?
Huh?
So, like, because people liked the ending because it let them end on a happy note and
no,
not
what
a sad note.
It picks up the energy right
yeah,
towards the end.
What I'm
so
saying,
you leave.
It's like a lengthy sequence with a lot of dance, and it's really visually neat to look at. So I think that, like, it's a thing that you don't see too often. And ergo, I think because it happens right at the end, people are like, this elevates the movie more for
yeah.
me.
Wow. There are two major things for me that are wrong with this
yeah,
ending. One, it's entirely unearned.
Yes.
I feel like it's trying to draw an emotional reaction out of an audience that doesn't have any kind of an emotional connection with these characters or their journey.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, there's a completely missed opportunity where they're walking by the Seine for her to take her shoes off and jump in the
yes.
river.
Yeah.
Which, why wouldn't you pay off on
I
that?
I cannot believe that no one thought
it
of that.
It was such
moment.
An obvious tee-up.
Absolutely.
Too. It would have been such a perfect capper. How did no one think of that?
It's really crazy.
Or if they didn't, why did they choose not to?
Mm-hmm.
I cannot think of a logistically speaking good reason as to why they would not include that.
It made me think of... I was waiting for the movie to end at that point.
Yeah.
I was like, this has gone on for a long time.
And it's a long... That segment is like really
it's
long.
A, it's
a very long
yeah.
segment.
So you got the home movies part.
Right,
it's
right.
really like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But during that...
Let
I
the
was...
record show that Brendan made a masturbating motion.
Like, oh, she's pregnant. Oh, they have
yeah.
a family. Oh,
he made that.
Right.
He made that rude
yeah.
fuck off, jack off gesture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I have two questions about the ending. One, are we supposed to feel that these two characters could have conceivably been in a relationship together? Like,
yes, we are supposed to feel that way.
Do you think they could have?
No,
yeah.
No, I don't either. Okay,
I think any woman with a shred of self respect would just see what Ryan Gosling's throwing out there and would just
yeah.
be like, "Done."
He's
bye.
He's a train wreck.
Been like,
yeah.
I tried to have fun, but you were so dour.
Yeah.
Get out of my face.
I think to the one thing I will give the movie credit for, Ryan Gosling does not seem to have a girlfriend at the end of the movie with him, and that is the most realistic part of the movie.
It's
as
also,
if he would still be living by himself. At
it also
point.
Makes you wonder, just like, what was their relationship? He's just. mansplaining jest.
Well, and again, as I
in
said,
the most condescending way.
How is he a better person for having been in this relationship?
He's not.
He's not. My other question, are we supposed to feel sad that they didn't end up together?
Yes.
The movie clearly wants us to feel regret.
Did you?
No.
No.
Okay, me neither.
I just kind of felt like this more bittersweet note of like, well, you know, in your life, you're going to have many big relationships and loves and whatnots. And that happens. Like, how interesting. But no, we get the schmaltzy alternate ending.
So over the top. It's like Damien Chazelle saw Up and was like, I'm going to do that, but in reverse. Because that movie does such a good job at like getting you in this world and getting you to know these characters and the circumstances of Carl's life, and then the story actually starts.
Yeah.
And this is the reverse, and that's not how you do it.
It's
how it works.
I would also just want to throw this out there. The scenes of Ryan Gosling playing jazz for just like crowds of ecstatic black people in jazz clubs made me feel so fucking uncomfortable. Because this presentation of him as this like the ideal jazz musician, and it's almost like they only just bring in black people without lines just to be like, look, here's some tacit approval. This is really backing it up.
What if John Legend and Ryan Gosling and traded roles?
That would be amazing.
I mean, I don't know if John Legend is a good enough actor to anchor like a movie, but like it's as a thought experiment.
But I think that's
but the performance level that Ryan Gosling was bringing in that role, John Legend could have probably.
No, I think he could have been very charismatic, I think. And again, given that the role does not, there's not a whole lot to endear you, I think John Legend's natural charisma would have endeared Sebastian slightly more. I mean, he would not have been, like, my first choice, probably, in terms of if you said, like, who's a good black actor to play Sebastian.
Right.
I probably wouldn't have initially said John Legend, but he would have been
He could have sung the songs. He could have done the dance.
Yeah.
It would have been great.
I think the racial stuff is problematic.
Yes.
But I think at the very least, what they could have done to sidestep this was have Sebastian listen to John Legend's friggin' character.
Yes!
They have that great interaction, and then nothing comes of it whatsoever.
John Legend gives him the straight dope.
Totally.
John Legend, I think, is the most pragmatic character in the movie.
Yeah.
He's the one who I probably would, like the most in real life.
Yeah.
Because he seems to know his shit.
One last point about the ending. The detail that his jazz club uses the logo that she designed for him, I think that's supposed to be our, like, one token of growth. Where they're like, look, he was flexible about this one superficial cosmetic thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the most he gets. So do we want to wrap it up and go to fixes?
I'll start. I feel like mine is kind of the loosest.
All right,
I really don't think it could have been that hard to find actors who could sing better and could also still put asses in the seats. Because it does seem like a very celebrity decision to make it Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, just because, yes, they are very charming, but they don't commit enough, and they just don't have the chops to sell a musical. I don't know. I would just change the story to probably be a more compelling thing. The idea I had kicking around, and I think me, you, and Lee discussed this, Brendan. I like the idea of maybe as a way of trying to introduce some more diversity into this, kind of make it about a queer actor who's on the cusp of making it and is also starting in this relationship, and they're not really sure whether, like, they're going to be at a position where maybe their sexuality is going to get in the way of this ambition that they have. And I think that's a much more compelling and interesting way to do that while also modernizing it.
Your fix is, like, make a different movie.
Well,
that's a very Lee fix, actually. You're bringing in the spirit of Lee.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to invoke her. But I just thought of that when I was watching it, of just, like, wow, it would have been such a more interesting way. And, you know, and I'm not trying to, like, insert too much of myself into this, but I just thought it would have been...
Maybe his name is Chris.
Maybe he's also a gay
maybe
man.
Maybe he's so handsome and has red hair.
From the East Coast. I mean, and then you can explore that. There's a darkness to that plot inherently. You can still kind of have the bubbliness you want on occasion. You just actually hire the singers you need to sing those songs with.
Yeah.
I found it sort of interesting that Emma Watson was also initially considered for this role.
Me too.
And then ended up being in Beauty and the Beast, where it has also proved that she's not a great singer. So it really does not seem like at any point they were courting people who are known for musical talent.
I was also thinking about this. If we're going to start doing that, I think we should go back to having, like, a singing double.
This is a whole other conversation.
We need more Marnie Nixons in the world.
Yeah.
But that's... Do you know what I mean, though? Yeah. And I have some singing doubles.
It's very in vogue to do your own singing, but, I mean, that would be a throwback, right?
Yes.
Totally.
I'm trying to think of, honestly, the last time a movie musical had someone dub a voice. And the only time I can remember is Phantom of the Opera, where they had an opera singer dub Minnie Driver.
Yeah.
That is the only time, like, maybe since, like the very late 70s or early 80s where we've done that in a movie. Like, it has just completely fallen out of fashion at this point.
Even Pierce Brosnan can do his own
singing. Yeah. Oh, yes. He can? Aside from like Disney movies where they would routinely like have a different like a singer,
yeah,
but like that's a little different.
Okay, so I had my main fixes focused on Mia's character. So I would love to see a lot of the things that Chris was talking about addressed as far as like diversity goes, but I was thinking more from like a story structural point and a stylistic point as well. Where I really liked the moment in someone in the crowd where everything slows down, and that got me thinking that should be a motif, and that would be a way to insert songs where Mia can kind of freeze a scene and analyze the scene and like kind of be outside of herself and the things that are happening. So for instance, you know, I on one hand, I really want to see her perform her show, but on the other hand, maybe she comes out of her own body and is able to slow down time and comment on like, oh, there's nobody in here in the audience, and oh, look, I messed up that line right now. And so that would also play into a sort of a Mia character change, in that Mia would be acting to make ends meet for some extra money or whatever, but she really wants to become a writer. It's not kind of this thing that she like stumbles into. And so, you know, kind of being able to freeze time and look around and analyze is kind of like her writer superpower.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see more, a stronger, more integral style filmmaking wise. Like, the movie's all over the place, from scene to scene, from number to number. Like, there are weird insert shots of stuff. There's that one weird insert shot in Seb's bedroom where there's like the water stain. And it just doesn't make any sense. And I want the kind of like heightened realism, the surreal stuff that is promised in the beginning of the movie, but doesn't really get paid off. So yeah, my other like fixes are like, why does she even need this jerk boyfriend? Like, he doesn't need to be in the movie at all. You know, and we talked about this kind of in
general. But
who would
Damien Chazelle's analog be?
I don't know. her like being able to slow down time would also give her time to like go like and get up on stage at the Messenger show and like sing about how she's feeling about Seb on the keyboards. I also think that Seb needs more musical numbers, and I felt like that moment where he's playing at the wedding was a perfect moment for him to be able to like reflect on what's going on in his own life and how he misses her or whatever. Instead of just being like another cut in like the 80th montage in the movie. So yeah, I really, you know, we kind of talked about this in like analyzing what is there in the movie the way that it exists. But the theme should really be like the glitz and the glamour and you know, your dreams, your ideal version of what you want to happen versus the reality is how you actually, you know, try to compromise and make things work.
Right.
And I think that also the theme of their relationship shouldn't be like this is a missed opportunity or something that could have been. This is more of a relationship where they needed each other for one key moment in their lives, and they made each other better people, and they both went on their separate paths afterwards. And the finale of the movie completely throws a wrench into that idea.
Yeah.
Mm. So the perspective that I took from all of this is, like I said, La La Land, for all its other faults, the biggest problem I have with it is that it is not a good musical. Like, from the point of what you want a musical to do, this movie does not do. So there are long stretches where no one sings. The entire middle of the movie has the only song you get, a reprise of City of Stars, and you get the John Legend song, which is sung on stage. So like it's like a diegetic number.
Right.
And I've heard people make weird arguments like that as like, you know, as their relationship becomes more strained, like the magic goes out of it, so they stop singing. That's bullshit. So what I did is, when I printed up the synopsis from Wikipedia, I wrote down 7 or 8 spaces where I think a song could have been inserted into this movie to make it a stronger musical. So what I've got here, and there's going to be some rustling of paper as I go through this. The first scene I had is where they have a lovely night sequence, and he meets her at the Warner Brothers back lot, and they like walk around the set real quick. I said Mia should have a song that explains her passion for acting, and I had written down perhaps a short, more up-tempo version of the audition song or something original going, this will go to another point later on. Whenever she is at a restaurant with her, I swear to God, I looked this up on IMDb, and her boyfriend, his name is literally like Greg Ernest. Like, E-A-R, like I'm just like, it's so close to being like bland, suitable choice, right, or something like that. When she is at this restaurant with him and like his brother and his brother's girlfriend or whoever, and they're having like a very like it, so it's weird. The movie wants you to, I think, to be like, this is such a stupid conversation, but he's basically just talking about like working in Japan or something. Yeah. Like it's not like he's like, and then I crunched more numbers at the office. Yeah. He's talking about how fucking being in Japan, like, get something from this.
And it's not even like he's being a bore about it. Like, no. He's not being like, he didn't use like a slur. Like, it's, there's nothing wrong.
I think the biggest failing is that none of them are Ryan Gosling, I think, is what the movie's problem is. But what I think is, I think they should be, frankly, less likable. And I think that a song showing the vapid nature of the dinner guests, a la Drop That Name from Bells Are Ringing or The Blob from Merrily We Roll Along. Mm. And she keeps getting snippets of Sebastian's musical theme during the song, similar to how she sort of hears it on the loudspeaker in the movie.
Yeah, that reminds her to go.
Yeah, until at the end it builds to a crescendo and she leaves. So, great. Like, you have this other song and then that you just keep hearing snippets of his theme. I think there should be a song for Mia's three-headed hydra of a roommate that gives him something to do. Because, like, one of the biggest fucking things that also bugs me about Sebastian is they show Mia at home with her roommates, and she's talking about writing a show. Sebastian pulls up outside, leans on the horn, and doesn't come in. I'm thinking, what a fucking dick. Like, you go up there, you introduce yourself to her roommates, and you pretend to be, like, a functioning person.
Her roommates have the same reaction. One of them's like, is he gonna do
that? Yeah, and then she's like, I think so. Like, it's, like, a fun thing to do. I'm like, no, this is like the sign of a jackass. And so I think that there should have been a song at that point between like the three roommates. Like, maybe it could have been directed at Mia, or maybe it just been the three of them being like, what the fuck is going on with, like, it could have been literally like, you know, if the movie wants it to be cute that he's doing this, they could have been like, ooh, like, who's her saucy new boyfriend? Or it could have been like, I'm worried that she's spending all her time with a fucking MRA. Yeah. But like,
one word should be part of the song too.
Yeah. Yes, there you go.
That would be fun.
There you go. You know, it's just talking about how Mia has changed since this dope who blasts his horn came into her life. Mia and Sebastian get into an argument over dinner, either like an argument in song form, like how fucking novel, right, or like something with like short tense verses where they're just like being like very curt with each other, so it's like very short like musical phrases like staccato, or like a song that keeps trying to start and can never start because like one of them busts out with something else and the song stops again.
Oh, wow. I like that.
Whenever she tells him that she's moving back to Boulder City, Nevada, like, hey, wouldn't it be neat if Mia was actually developed in some way here? Like, if she had a ballad to tell us about, like, her, like, about things about herself aside from I Love the Movies. Like, maybe, like if the initial song where she talks about her passion isn't, like, a variation on the audition number, maybe it could be, like, a short musical theme that's developed in this sequence mm-hmm. as a lengthier theme for her to talk about. And, you know, it could be melodically similar to that. The scene where after her audition goes well, where Sebastian and Mia, like, say that they'll love each other, but they don't know what's going to happen. Like, this is fucking musical theater 101.
Right.
It's a song. I'm not going to, like, do this for you. This is a song. And before, at the end, like, right when they sort of, like, leave and smile at each other, like, it doesn't need to be a big thing, but there should be a little something here. Like, loath as I am to be like, City of Stars should show up one more time in this fucking movie, maybe it should, or maybe alternatively, like, it should end with them like sort of smiling at each other, they walk out, and as she's like walking out, there's a reprise of another day in this, another sunny day, whatever the fuck,
another day of sun,
yeah, as they're like, as she's like walking down the street, like, it builds to sort of like that again, and you're like, okay, like, it is kind of okay, like, it didn't work out for them, but like, maybe things are all right.
Right.
And the last thing I had is that, also similar to what you had said, wouldn't it be neat if maybe Sebastian's sister had a purpose in this movie? Like, maybe she sings a song at the wedding to him that like helps him learn something, or changes a character, or like shows her perspective on love and relationships, because she just got married, so presumably she knows something. Like, this is, it gives Rosemary DeWitt something to do.
I was gonna say,
which she has nothing to do in this movie.
As it is a waste of Rosemary DeWitt.
She shows up in the beginning and then just scene. Like pops up in montage form and never says anything else. There should be, frankly, at least one more song with more than two singers in the second half of the movie, so maybe that should be at the wedding also. Like, there needs to be more ensemble work. And really, this is what I have for La La Land. The problems are still there in totally. Terms of things, but like, you can have a slight story and still be captivating. Like,
yeah.
Just because there's not a whole lot going on, it doesn't mean it's bad. If you have charismatic people, and if you have, like, in a musical, like, if you have good songs that are strengthening these people, you can get away with something slight.
Absolutely.
And I think that is what the biggest failing is for me in terms of an original musical.
I would also say, if you wanted to make a musical, then commit to it. Don't, I mean, I feel like it was such a now thing to try to, like, undercut it with this naturalistic and ironic thing to it. Just commit. Make a fucking musical.
Or go full ironic, right? Where they're kind of stuck in this world where everybody else is breaking out in song, but they're not, you know, maybe later on they break out in song as they start their relationship. Like, they're surrounded in this musical world and they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, like, they're not happy people, so they don't sing naturally until, like, they meet each other and then they start to. So there you go, Damien.
That would be really poignant, actually. Wow. So I guess the classic question is, would we recommend it?
No, I wouldn't.
I don't think I would either.
I would tell someone if it's on an airplane, then watch it on the airplane.
Yeah, I feel like
it'll probably have more emotional resonance when you're in that like vulnerable space that you're
30,000 feet above.
Exactly.
Go see like anything else that was up for the Oscars.
there are so many better musicals than this. This is not, for my money, this is not revolutionary as a musical. This is kind of interesting in the way it is shot and looks. But this is not, like, some breakthrough in what musical theater has been doing. Musical theater has been shown, like, if you, like, I think anyone who thinks this is revolutionary in terms of what a musical is has seen Mamma Mia and nothing else. Like, it's like, you think a musical is, like, that, or you once saw The Sound of Music. And, like, this is all you have to work with. Musicals are so much more than that. And, like, musicals, it's an art form that I love, and I will always champion. And this is why I think I felt so, like, passionate about this movie, because when it is, like, done badly and people are like, this is so much different from another musical I've ever seen, it's because you probably don't know much about it.
And it's just a bummer that that many people stood up to applaud this movie as a great musical, not.
And I think that's a double-edged sword, right? Because we were talking about how it might be a good thing that this encourages development of other original movies, musicals, but also maybe if they're like more like this, please, then they won't be so good.
Right, the wrong lessons might be learned here at the end of the day, which is what worries me more.
Me too. Well, and it's crazy to me because it's like, did we all just forget? Like, if you wanted like a really good movie musical in the past 10 years, like fucking Chicago was amazing.
Chicago's perfect. Well,
Chicago wasn't in the past 10 years at this point.
Was it?
No, I'm pretty sure
that was 2002.
Like, yeah.
Oh, guys, I'm so old.
Yeah, you are. But no, and there were well done musicals in the past like several years.
Into the Woods is pretty good.
I think Into the Woods turned out pretty well. I'm like blanking on other shit that's happened recently, like. I don't think Les Miserables was very good, but I don't think the stage show is very good. Like, I think the movie is as good of an adaptation sans Russell Crowe singing that you could have of Les Miserables. Like, I think this is what the best case scenario for Les Miserables. Like,
which, I mean, I disagree with you in terms of I really enjoyed the movie, but it's just so weird to me that everyone's just so blown away and, like, declaring this the revival of the movie musical. Mm-hmm. We've had such better ones have already come in recent years.
I think Muppets Most Wanted is a better movie musical.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Like, so, like, movie musicals, for whatever reason, like, it seems to be, like, a genre that always has to constantly defend its existence. Like, if a musical fails, executives are like, it failed because it was a musical.
Right.
And, like, whereas opposed to, like, if a comedy fails, they're not like, oh, people don't like comedies anymore. It's like, this failed because there was singing.
Yeah.
And that is like the rough thing about being a fan of movie musicals is that they don't happen very often.
Yeah.
And when they do, you always run the risk of it being like terrible and people don't see it and therefore like they stop making them for a while.
I think it's also reflective of a struggle that we saw present in La La Land, I think, which is it's so hard to just do a musical in the old style and just have it be that, because that's considered too cheesy or too something.
People won't buy it.
For a more like modern sensibility. And the modern sensibility dictates a lot of movie musicals have these tough waters to navigate in. How do we still give them a song and dance number, but fold it in somehow?
Yeah, we gotta get them on board.
Yeah. So like Chicago's way of doing that was that all of the numbers were happening inside Roxy's head.
Mm-hmm. But Chicago's, to be fair, Chicago's way of doing it that way is actually pretty authentic to the stage show, because in the stage show, like, the actions kind of stop, and, like, the band leader will be like, and now Roxy will sing a song.
Right.
And so, like, in the sense that they are all fantasy numbers, it is very close to the stage show. So it's not like it was, like a failure of that is, like, 9, everything should be happening on stage, but then it will stop and be like, this is a fantasy sequence in the director's head.
I think that one thing that comes to mind in talking about, like, getting audiences to buy musicals are the various Disney musicals, like, and how there seems to be some sort of a trend where some of them are full-on, like, structurally exactly like a Broadway show, like The Lion King, but towards the end of the 90s, we had stuff that had less music, like Mulan.
And you went to Tarzan, where it was all sung by
Exactly, yeah. And so it's also weird to see, like, how it's kind of based in trends, or maybe it's the subject matter. They don't think that people will buy people breaking out in the song in this
is in this kind of a story.
But it's so funny, right? Because it's like a miscalculation. They're like, how do we get people who don't like musicals to watch them?
Yeah.
We try to make it less of a musical.
Also, there's an issue where people don't want to pay attention to lyrics. Like, even when we saw Moana, there were like, the guy next to me just kept checking his phone every time they broke into song.
Really?
And so it's like, if you, so like if you have it automatically in your head that every song is not going to be something you have to care about, when there is like, when there are musicals with songs where you actually have to listen to, you're just going to like tune it out and be like, nope, it's going to be like everything else. And like, to be fair, like with any other genre, there are good musicals and there are bad musicals, but like, you have to, like, when they are well done, the songs, as we said, will develop the plot or the characters, and they will take you to places at the end that you were not at in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand that this is a possibility, and you have to fucking pay attention to mm-hmm. it. All right, so I think we've about wrapped this up. If we have nothing else to say, I think at this point, drappack.com, facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. Brendan, thank you for coming out here.
Thank
to talk
you for
about
having me. This was lovely.
Yeah, no, I'm glad we got to do
me
this.
Me too.
Because we've had so much to say about La La Land. We will see you guys in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
All right. See you guys then. Bye.